There's a place some of us go each fall. A place where the ring of a bell filters through the covers and hurried shouts of "Bird up!" bring everybody to attention. A place where the playful puppies around our house are transformed here to driven bird finders. And where there is confidence in the slow pace of the silver-muzzled old veterans. Where our friends tell the same old stories each year, and none of us seem to mind. Where great shots are forgotten, and epic misses never fade. Where an old gun will have a story to tell, if only it could speak to us. Where all the good seats are claimed by the dogs. If you have a camp, you know these things all too well. If you don't, well, you're always welcome here. So pull up a chair, tell us about your favorite gun or dog, and we'll admire the birds together and talk the night away by the fire. Welcome to Bird Camp. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Bird Camp podcast. I am your host, Joe Schwenke. And again, of course, we'll start by thank you for listening. For those of you that do share or like and subscribe, all those things, of course, I appreciate the electronic support that way, as well as those on Patreon for your few dollars here and there. And of course, that enables me to do a few more things. And of course, always appreciated there with the sponsors as well. A few quick things, of course. Remember the Andy Cullen Seminar. You can check that out at Blackbriar Spaniels on Facebook. If you can find Mike Pollock and get a hold of him if you're interested in the Flushing Dog Spaniel, or Flushing Dogs in general. Yeah, so Labradors can be there as well as others. Andy Cullen is great. You need to, if you can, I'll have him on the podcast to listen to. But meeting him in person is always fun. And so I'm looking forward to that as that gets closer, of course. Be involved where you can with, like the previous episode with Pheasants Forever, find an event to go to, try to get involved, bring a youth, of course, all those things. Ways to correspond with the podcast, of course, mi.birdcamp@gmail.com is the email. I do check that fairly regularly, as well as on Instagram at birdcamppod. And Bird Camp on Facebook. And if you do send me a friend request, please send a message as well so that I don't leave you in the digital dustbin of the friend requests. And I know it's you. I try to get listeners priority on that acceptance there. Well, with that, I will get right into the first two sponsors. We're going to go with Wildcard Outfitters and Guide Service first, a Michigan-based outfitter specializing in mentoring new hunters with the educational and positive experience in the outdoors, offering upland bird hunting for rough grouse and woodcock, walleye charters, waterfowl hunting, and guided bear hunts and more. Contact Wildcard Outfitters and Guide Service for one of these unforgettable experiences. And Aspen Thicket Grouse Dogs, located in the central UP, offering grouse-centered dog training and home to Uncle Grouse. Aspen Thicket knows that the rough grouse is essential to developing the skills to effectively pursue the king. From puppy development through finished dog work, you can trust Uncle Grouse with your hunting companion. If you're dissatisfied with your uncle... If you're dissatisfied with your uncle, I can't help you, but if you're... I will explain why I am so... It seems like out of shape already. If you are dissatisfied with your grouse hunting, try doing what your uncle told you to do. I'm a little flustered, and that is because just before I wanted to make this phone call, I see one of our dogs, in fact my dog, go running across the yard and directly into the neighbor's. And he was supposed to be on the chain, get a little airing out just before I hit start on this. And then I had to go outside and help wrangle him back from the other side of the neighbor's property with my son Caleb. And so I am out of breath and completely taken off my game, which evidently has affected my ability to recognize words on a page. So with that, of course, we have our guest. I will introduce you. This is Dean from Clear Cut Kennel. Welcome, Dean, to the podcast.
Thank you very much. And your note is you were chasing a dog around, and I... pray to God that over the next hour, no one pulls into my driveway because my dogs will start barking and you'll hear them in the background. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
It's part of owning dogs.
It is, and he's been usually real good in the yard, and lately he's had a thing for the neighbor's yard. I don't know what it is, but that's not now the first time in the last month we've had to go get him. But so we'll start this off, and the reason, well, I'll give credit to where it's due. A listener, Dennis Edelmeyer, recommended I get you on, so I did a little bit of snooping around the social media and said, yeah, definitely, this sounds like fun. And one of those things was I saw pictures of you, and in this case it was one of your sons, but now I know you have more than one son, and you had been out hunting, and that kind of sealed the deal for me right there. So tell me a bit about hunting, both as you were as a kid and now with your own kids.
Well, at Clearcut Kennel, my passion has always been grouse dogs, and my passion started out as probably about a 7 or 8 year old boy following my dad through the woods in northern Minnesota. He was a very big deer hunter, so every October he would go up and repair his deer stand and look for deer signs, and he would always carry a shotgun, and we'd walk the tote roads, and when the grouse would get up, he would shoot at the grouse, and that became more my passion than the deer hunting. And I can remember as a small child tugging him on the jacket saying, Dad, wouldn't this be a great place to live? And I've always had a passion for grouse hunting in northern Minnesota. And later on in life after college, I moved up here to breed and train grouse dogs. But I also pass that on to my kids. I tell my wife, Jill, that if something ever happens to me, you make sure my kids still have access to the grouse woods and grouse hunting, because I want them to experience the same joy that I've had. Hunting wild birds in northern Minnesota. So it's each one of them have had their own dog to train and go hunting with over the years, and it's just been a real family affair for us. It turned into a family business, and each of us to this day play a part in it. So it's been, it puts a smile on mom and dad's face, that's for sure.
It does. I'm in that same boat, right? I'm in kind of the middle of your timeline where I'm at. And sons with dogs and wanting to get on the birds. And does it change the value of your hunting? And this is kind of the obvious question. I found that it changes the value of my hunting if I'm out with my kids. It's a different hunt.
Yeah, I am a big member of the Rough Grouse Society, and we have that National Grouse and Woodcock here in Grand Rapids every October. And for a number of years on my kids were young, for about 10 years, I guided in Division II. I bring my dogs over there. You get assigned 200s, and you go out and you bring, a donor to the Rough Grouse Society out grouse hunting for the day. And that was kind of a competitive thing where you get so many points for a shot grouse and a shot woodcock. And as my kids got older, I got away from doing that because I wanted to spend time with them. So I quit doing that, and my big joy now is just going out and spending an afternoon or a day with one of my kids. Get them away from the computers and their nose in their laptop or their cell phones, and get them out and really, really enjoy, Mother Nature and grouse and woodcock and deer. I tell them all the time, if you do this long enough, cool things happen to you. See all sorts of neat things, and it's just a fun way to get out in the outdoors and enjoy the family. And all my kids do it, and I hope it goes on in the next generation as well. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yep. I noticed as my kids were young, we took them anyway. They came with us because we were going to be hunting. And they had the attention span. We had to do a little bit with that when they were younger, and that was promise them that there was going to be action at some point. And then when it was true enough times, now I noticed that they're eagerly sitting there. The waiting got easier now that they're mid-teens. And when they were young, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. And we had to always battle, like, stick it out. You're going to, mallards fly at 10, or there's going to be woodcock. It's a matter of where we can find them. And then now all of a sudden now it's a little different. Like, oh, well, we could, yeah, we can go a little further. Yeah, we can wait a little longer. They've clicked that switch.
Mm-hmm.
And what a thrill.
I experienced the same thing when they were young. My youngest son, Caleb, I remember him. He carried this little thing he got for Christmas. It was a little cage that you put bugs in, and he'd carry that with him. He would find bugs, and I remember we were over on a logging road one time, and these little snakes were all over the road. I wanted to get into the grouse woods, but we spent an hour hunting snakes on the dirt road. There were just tons of them. But it's just little things like that that, you know, then they want to go the next time. And in mm-hmm. that in that exact same spot, we found a bear's den in the woods. And every time to this day, my kids are in there, you know, they're a young adult now. And we are every time we go down that logging road, let's go check out the bear den. It was and just memories that you have with the family is just it's really cool. And I look back at myself. My favorite moments of my childhood were in northern Minnesota, camping, fishing, and mostly October walking logging roads with my dad and my brothers. And, you know, we'd be able to, one of us would be lucky enough we could bring a friend with us. And those were the best moments ever. I mean, you know, and I wanted to share that same thing with my kids. And mm-hmm. we all deer hunt, and my rule is, I sat in a deer stand with each one of my kids until they shot their first deer, and then they were allowed to sit in the stand alone. But I wouldn't trade that for anything. What great experiences! It was mm-hmm. it's fun. That's I'm glad that they got the passion.
Yeah.
For just being outside, it's great. So.
Yeah, watching them shoot their first deer, I've now done that with both my boys,
mm-hmm.
and I would hate to have not been there now.
Yeah.
The grins and the excitement and the shakes and everything that I don't hardly remember that happened to me when I was 16. Here they are 14, 13. And mm-hmm. yeah, that same, a little bit of reliving things that I'd kind of forgotten happened right there in that blind.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I've always told them that, you know, when you're sitting in the deer stand, you can get really cold. But the second that deer comes out, you're all of a sudden you're hot.
Mm-hmm.
and it's just, and you know, yeah, dad, they don't believe you until it happens to them. And then,
mm-hmm.
or the kick of the gun when they're target practicing, they really can feel that kick. But you ask them, did you feel the kick after you shot that deer? Didn't feel a thing, dad.
Mm-hmm.
Just all those little things that we've experienced when we were growing up and, you know, and sharing and watching them experience the same thing. It's just,
yep.
It's fun.
It is, and I admit I needed the refresher too. You know, and the added excitement of seeing them do it kind of rekindles a little there, and
it changes your perspective as an adult when you have kids mm-hmm. and you're bringing them along into the same traditions and
yep.
And it's what makes life worth living, in my opinion. So
it is, and I kind of know from our pre-talk it was almost now a month ago.
Yeah,
you've kind of started out with Gordon Setters.
Yeah, I started out just, my dad was allergic to dogs. He had asthma really bad.
Mm.
And when we got to high school, there was a magazine called Fins and Feathers. It was kind of started in Minnesota. And the very first issue they had was about bird dogs. And it was a Chesapeake Bay, American Water Spaniels. And I can't remember what the third dog was, but I grew up in Blaine, which is a northern suburb of Minneapolis, and there was advertisement in that magazine for American Water Spaniels. And my younger brother Dale, he was, Dad, let's go look at him. Let's go look at him. And we just hounded Mom and Dad for a dog, and we ended up with an American Water Spaniel. So my first experience was a flushing dog, and that was a lot of fun. And then I went to college, and I realized that, you know, my favorite thing to do is grouse hunting, and I always wanted to have a pointing dog. So I kind of researched them in college. I used to go to the library and study different pointing dogs, and I wanted something different that not everyone else had, and I just kind of landed on a picture of a Gordon Setter. I had never seen one, but the articles that I would read in my research would, you know, on the East Coast back in the 1800s and when grouse hunting was market hunting in the East Coast, people would be running English setters and English pointers, and they oftentimes mentioned Gordon setters. So I started doing a little research on them, and, you know, they hunt the red grouse in Scotland is what they were bred for, and they're supposedly good grouse dogs, so that's kind of how I got into my first Gordon Setter. I was in college, and ended up buying him, and he was one heck of a grouse dog. I shot so many pointed birds over that dog. It was phenomenal, and after I seen him point his first rough grouse, I could never go back to a flushing dog. There was just something about the thrill of that point and that flush and that shot. I couldn't even tell you if I hit the bird or not. It was just, the point was just like, wow. You know, that was pretty exciting for me. And I just I've had a passion for the Gordon Setter ever since. And, you know, it's an unusual dog, black and tan. And to this day, you can walk down the street and people will ask you, what kind of dog is that? Is that a cross between a black lab and whatever? And, no, it's a purebred dog. And so it's a minority breed, you know. It's not like an English setter where there's so many English setters and German short hairs, and part of the reason I fell in love with it further as the years went on was you can really contribute to the development of the breed because it is a minority breed, and there's not a lot of people breeding them for hunting. So I got added enjoyment from doing that, and then you throw grouse hunting on top of that, which is even more specialized of a dog.
Yep.
And when I went out to buy a second Gordon Setter, I thought all pointing dogs were great on grouse. Like my first one, Tanner was his name, and I found out the hard way that they're not. The next dog didn't point grouse the way I wanted, then I bought another one that didn't work out, and I slowly figured out, hey, if I'm going to keep Gordon Setters and have good grouse dogs, I'm going to have to breed them myself. So that's kind of how I got into starting my own line of grouse dogs. So it's been fun.
Yeah. And now you've done this now quite a while. I thought I'd read 40 years.
Yeah, it's been 40 years. I don't feel like I'm that old to be doing something that long. But I got my first dog, I think it was 1983 was when I bought my first Gordon Setter, my first bird dog that I owned. So yeah, 40 years, that's a long time.
Yeah.
What I did was I eventually found another Gordon Setter that pointed grouse at a really high level, and I bred my best female at that time to that dog, and I just kept that whole litter, and I ran them in the grouse woods, and I just picked out the best grouse dog out of that litter, and I just kind of started a line breeding program based on that. And I look back at my early dogs outside of the first dog I had. That dog just pointed. It was almost like if you'd see 15 birds in the woods, he'd point 15 of them. He was just that good of a dog. So when I started my own breeding program, I normally move about 30 birds a day, whether it's a bottom of a cycle or the top of a cycle. And with 30 bird contacts, my early dogs, I'd get 10 or 12 of those birds pointed, which just was not good enough for me. So that's when I bred to, actually it was a dog by the name of Springset Ice Hot, which individual I like to say his name, Phil Holinka, owned the dog. And he had a really good reputation in Minnesota of being a really, really good grouse dog. And one of my best friends went hunting with him one afternoon, and he came back and he called me up, and he was just beside himself talking to me. He says, Dean, you wouldn't believe this dog. And we shot so many birds. I said, you know, Paul, I don't care how many birds you shot. How many did the dog point? And the phone kind of went silent. And he said, I don't think he bumped one bird. He pointed them all. And they said they hunted for a half day, and they had like, the number in my mind is like between 30 and 40 bird contacts, grouse and woodcock. So I figured, yeah, that sounds just like my Tanner dog. And so I got a hold of Phil, and I was fortunate enough to breed my female to his dog, and that what kind of started everything. So, but it's, you know, to have a good grouse dog, you need good genetics, and finding them is hard. So over the years, I move 30 birds now, and I can get 25 on a good day and get them all pointed. And that's way better than where I started out from. And, but that's, you know, keeping pups out of every litter, running them through the grouse season. And I always say that I tell Lucas, who's my oldest son, who's going into this business with me. He's 21 years old now, and that's what he wants to do for a living. So, and I tell Luke, I wish I could have started where you started, because 40 years ago it was there's a lot of heartache, you know, highs and lows in breeding dogs, and to get the genetics that you wanted into the dog to point grouse at the level I wanted them was a real science project. It's been a lot of fun, but there's a lot of heartache in it as well. So,
right, and but. So kind of then thinking about this now that we've kind of settled a baseline with what you do. Can I ask you then a different question? And that is, as a breeder, when you're looking at puppies, are there certain young dog characteristics that you almost have to see to want the dog?
So you're, I line breed. So line breeding is, you're inbreeding is where you breed really tight, but you breed within the family of your dogs. But when you have a minority breed, like the Gordon said, and there's not a lot of genetics out there, you have to populate your kennel with enough diversity so you're not too tight on your breeding program.
Yep.
So what I did was I have 12 runs dog kennel, and then I have an additional 8 runs that I use just for training dogs. So when I breed a litter of pups now, I'll keep a pup out of that litter, and they have to prove themselves as a grouse dog before they'll ever get in my breeding program. But a lot of those pups now come back year after year, so I get to see the pups that I produce from previous, you know, generations and breedings.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, every once in a while, a dog comes in out of my breeding program. That's I kind of look at it as like a deck of cards. I'm looking as a breeder. I'm looking for the face cards. I don't want to breed to the fives and the sixes and the sevens. I want the kings, the queens, and the aces. So when those 8 kennels that I have, so I train 8 dogs a month. Mostly Gordon setters out of my breeding program, or any Gordon setter from any breeder. I train lots of Gordon setters. And that's how I kind of pick my breeding stock.
Mm-hmm.
I get to see them. I get my hands on them. I get, you know, how is this dog compared to this dog? But for my breeding program, when I started out, I wanted to have a good, honest family dog. And Gordon setters they're just wonderful family pets. They're not guard dogs. They're alarm dogs. If somebody comes to the door and knocks on the door, he's going to bark, but he's not going to try to bite anybody. And as soon as you know, the Gordon sees that as a friend, then they want to, you know, they let down, and they're good with kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just wonderful family dogs. I say they're stop-and-go dogs. Around the house, they've got an off switch. You pull out the shotgun, or they know they're going hunting, and then they turn into a good hunting dog.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's number one thing for me, was it had to be a nice family dog. Number two for me, they have to be proven grouse dogs before I'll ever breed them. And so I want dogs that'll go in and just point a super high percent of the birds. I want to have a dog that can run all day and get up the next day and go do it again. So you're looking for good confirmation. And one of the things I say about confirmation is I don't care if the dog's 90 pounds. I don't care if the dog's 30 pounds. If he can run all day and hunt all day, I'll use them in my breeding program if he's a proven grouse dog. But having said that, over 40 years of breeding, almost every single one of my dogs fit between 40 and 50 pounds right now. And that's the athletic body, that weight range. If you start getting over 30 or over 60 pounds, they're still going to hunt, but they're going to get tired out. Look at a football team.
Yep.
They're all athletes. But the linemen, offensive line, defensive line, they're big boys. You know, they're made to protect try to get at the quarterback or protect the quarterback. It's the same thing with dogs. They're athletes, but if you're going to ask them to run for 6 hours straight, they're carrying all that extra weight, and they usually have bigger bone, and they just can't keep that up. They can do it because mentally they want to, but they slow way down. A dog in the 40 to 50 pound range, they're like the running backs and the marathon runners. They can go and go and go.
Yep. So you want the ones that kind of really do, they look like the track stars at the Olympics.
Yeah. I mean, they can, you know, and as a breeder, I don't need a dog to run all day. I've got a kennel full of dogs. One dog gets tired, I reach in the truck, I grab another dog and put him down for an hour. But my customers, the people who want Gordon Setter for grouse hunting or pheasant hunting, that's probably going to be their only dog. And I feel it's my responsibility to, you know, provide a good hunting dog that can hunt 2, 3, 4 days in a row if they're in shape. And that's the weight in, of dog that has the athletic ability to do that. And then the other thing is I don't, Gordon Setters, you get a lot of that show breeding. They'll get a lot of coat on them. I've consciously tried to breed a dog with less coat. I like a nice straight coat. If you go out pheasant hunting with them, they don't collect as many burrs. A dog that's draping in a lot of coat, you have to give them a hair, like humans, you have to give them a haircut every 2 months. I have dogs that are 3 and 4 years old that have never had a haircut, and they look like they had one last week because I breed that coat on them. Not all of them do that, but that's what I tend towards when I breed.
Right. Does that make them more heat tolerant as well?
Yeah, they're not, you know, they're smaller. So I always tease some of my show friends, you know, I can fit 3 of them in the front of my pickup truck and they eat a third as much food and give me 3 times the production out in the field, you know, versus an 80-pound dog in the truck.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're more heat tolerant. Lost my train of thought there a little bit, but so if you go out to South Dakota with that nice coat, your buddies who might be running short hairs, they're in having their beer and their steak, and you're out there, I don't want to be the one out there cutting burrs out of my dog's coat. So I try to breed for that type of a coat. Can you see that at 7, 8 weeks when somebody's coming to pick up a pup? I think you can. Genetically, it's there because I line breed, so my dogs don't carry all that coat. But Gordon Setter, you can get wavy coat, the straight coat, and you can start seeing that at about 7 or 8 weeks of age. You can also see tail set. I like a nice high tail on my dogs. And you can start seeing that if you around the litter all the time, which ones are going to carry a straight tail and a high tail versus a low tail or a sickle tail. So you can start seeing some of those things at 7 and 8 weeks of age when you're picking out the pup. People ask me, you get too hung up on the high tail, and it's not high on my list, but it's on my list. I mean, to me, that tail's connected to the brain of the dog. And when that dog's on point in the woods and you're walking up to him, that tail's telling you whether it's a grouse, it's a woodcock, I have the bird pinned, I don't have it pinned. Just looking at that tail will tell you, give you a lot of information about what's going on in front of that dog's nose. So if you're breeding a dog that can't get his tail above horizontal or it just hangs there, he can't give you as much information. That's how I look at it. And you know, a dog that's standing there with a head high and a tail high, he just looks like he's, you know, he owns the place. And that's what I like, that positive attitude, gear positive type dog is what I look for. So
right. I think I asked this question before, but it was, any ability milestones that you look for when you're evaluating? Is it something where normally you should say, well, at a certain age-ish, and it's of course always a little bit dependent on exposure, but are you looking for in the first 6 months having them on a couple of grouse and seeing are they getting faster when they hit scent? Do they get shorter? Or slower? Do they actually point right away? Are there things out there that you're noticing in your puppies? You know, in that,
well, the
first
Gordon Setter
months.
As a breed, is a slower maturing dog. You get like the short hair breed; they can take a lot of training early at a much younger age. Where a Gordon Setter, and I'll even say I train enough English Setters and Irish Setters, they're just a slower maturing breed. What you short hair can do at 7-8 months of age, a Gordon Setter might take, you know, 15 to 16 months of age to get to that same spot. Hmm. But the one thing I've noticed over the years, through always picking the best grouse dog and breeding to the best grouse dog to breeding to the best grouse dog, is I've developed my earlier dogs would take 2 to 3 years before I would really get a dog that would consistently point grouse. I have dogs right now that are 8-9 months old that are pointing rough grouse. I mean, and so I think through my selection process, mm-hmm. is I've developed a dog that pointing instinct is so... Grouse are tough for a pointing dog to handle. That's why you put any pressure mm-hmm. on a grouse yeah. in Minnesota here, and it results in a flushed bird. So having that as your number one barometer and choosing your breeding stock, I think over the years I've developed a dog with a really, really high pointing instinct that can actually start pointing birds at a very, very young age. And that's something you want to see genetically if you're breeding dogs. Mm-hmm. So that's something I've noticed over the years, that I know I've improved that part of the genetics of my dogs anyways.
Yeah. So. Have you noticed, has the maturity sped up as you've bred over 40 years?
Yeah, Delmar Smith, talking to him one time at Game Fair, and he, and I think there's a lot of truth to this. He says, on years of high wild bird populations, you're going to produce a lot of great bird dogs. Years with low wild bird populations, you're not going to develop or breed or get a lot of great bird dogs. Wild birds make great dogs. And so I think there's a lot of truth to that. I spend most of my time running my dogs on grouse. I moved to northern Minnesota. I live right in grouse country. So I got my dogs have a steady, steady diet of grouse. So you got to have birds, and then the cream rises to the top. I mean, I try to go into every fall with 4 young dogs, and then every 2 or 3 years, I find a dog that's just 8 months old, just doing it. Like, that's the dog I want to breed to. You can't teach that genetics. It's either genetically in there or it's not in there. Mm-hmm. So you're always looking for those dogs that just naturally do it. But you got to get them on grouse. You can't go 3 weekends a year grouse hunting and know if you have a good bird dog or a bad bird dog. It takes a lot of birds. Yeah. There's a writer, Bill McClure, wrote an article, I want to say back in the mid-80s, for Gun Dog Magazine. And the title of the article was 500 Grouse. And he says it takes 500 grouse contacts to make a grouse dog. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. So I've always kind of put pen to paper. And on a good year, like this year in Minnesota, I moved 40-plus birds a day. On an average or a down year, if I really get after it, I can move 30 birds a day. And I hunt more than 60 days a year. So just do the math on that. If I bring 4 dogs into the grouse woods, and I move 30 birds a day, that's 1,800 grouse contacts in the course of a 60-day season. That's 450 birds per dog if I run in 4 dogs, 4 young dogs. Mm-hmm. If I'm on a good year like this year, the math goes up. That's 600 bird contacts a day. I'm not talking about woodcock. I'm talking just about rough grouse. Mm-hmm. When you can get your dog on that many birds, he's telling you can pick which one is the best one. There's going to be a dog that consistently finds and points birds.
Yeah.
And you can't teach it to them. All you can do is drop them in the cover, and they figure it out or they don't figure it out. So mm-hmm. I'm looking for those dogs that can handle those, mm-hmm. you know, with that many contacts, which you hold your own little field trial every fall. 4 dogs. Which one is the best dog? That's the one you're keeping.
Yep.
And that's how, in my mind, how I've always went after my breeding program. Yeah. October 15th, in the middle of the grouse woods, you sit on your favorite drumming log and you ask yourself, is this dog a breedable dog? And that's kind of how I try to approach things for my breeding program.
Yep, and even the worst dog out of those four, after 450 contacts, is still going to be darn good.
Yeah, so I'm,
it's just not
30
good
years
enough.
Ago, maybe not, but now I'm splitting hairs. I might have all four of those dogs might be doing everything, but one's got a poker straight 12 o'clock tail. Oh, that's probably the one I'm going to keep. Or this one has a natural retrieve. Oh, that's a bonus.
Yeah.
This one has a little better coat, so you're splitting hairs. But whoever gets those other three dogs, or on a bad year where I don't keep any of them, more than likely that's going to be that person's best dog they've ever owned because of all the time and energy and the genetics, 40 years worth of grouse genetics is in that dog. Mm-hmm. I'm splitting hairs at a breeder. I'm looking for kings, queens, and aces for my breeding program. You know, eights, nines, tens, and jacks, they're great dogs.
Yeah, they're just not hitting the bar for you. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's kind of how I look at it.
Yep. And I know, I think two seasons ago I had another setter guy on, Scott Berg, and we talked a bit about what the grouse demand out of a dog. So when you're saying 450 contacts and a high percentage of points, this is a dog that has to intelligently adapt, has to get out there and quest for game in all kinds of conditions, right? 60 days of season, it could be 75 and sunny to 10 degrees and halfway snowing, and everything in the middle for wind and moisture, and you have a dog that's going to have to overcome all the normal kind of nature obstacles and still find that bird, still be smart enough to point it, you know, the right caution at the right time. All those things still have to be in there. Yeah.
It's exactly right. And then, you know, the other little thing I've always noticed is you're bringing young dogs open, and most people don't hunt open. I'm retired now, so I do nothing but bird dogs. But when I was the working man, I would take the first 2 weeks of the grouse season off. I had the woods to myself because you're still swatting mosquitoes and the leaves are still on and it's 70 degrees out. But those young dogs are having contacts with young rough grouse that have never seen a dog or a human before.
Mm-hmm.
So you got young birds with young dogs, so they kind of learn together.
Mm-hmm.
And then put that forward 60 days. Now you're in the end of November or the first part of December, and all the birds have been picked over. Those birds now are smart birds. You put any pressure on that bird and he's just gone. So it's better to have a dog pointing late season birds than early season birds. Don't mean a lot. Late season birds mean a lot because they're the toughest of the tough birds to handle for a dog. So you kind of take all that into in consideration when you're developing these dogs. The other thing that I do is during my training, I try to mimic grouse hunting with my dogs as young all the way through their life. So I always say the wildest bird in the world is a pigeon out of my bird releaser, because I put that bird out in my field or on the edge of the woods, and I do not let my dogs point that bird for a very long time. That bird is just harder than heck for that dog to point. And I always give the example, say you have a 40-acre field, and you always run your dog from the south to the north, and you always put your pigeon up on the north border. That dog gets to the halfway point and is making his move to the north border, and he puts any pressure on that bird or gets even close, I just fly the bird. I want the dog to see the bird, not necessarily smell it. Well, if you do that every single day, about 3 weeks into your training program, that dog knows there's a bird up there, and he's trying his hardest. He will actually point the field knowing that there's a bird there. That's when I start letting them scent point. So I make that pigeon, I try to mimic a real, so a really, really tough bird to handle. And then when I do let him point it, the second he moves even a paw or crouches or does anything, I fly the bird. You moved, you scared the bird up. That's one of the number one things I've done over the years with these young dogs to get them ready for the grouse season. It really works. They go into their first grouse season. Grouse end up being a little bit easier than that pigeon was.
Hmm.
So they get that first rough grouse scent on them, boom, a lot of times they just lock right up on point. So is it better genetics, or is it maybe the way I've developed them too? That's why I can take an eight-month-old dog into the grouse woods and get lots of grouse pointed. I think part of it is my training program with these pigeons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I read a lot of training books and stuff, and I've never really known anybody to do that, and it's just something I've kind of come up myself. And it really, really works for me. You know, steady to wing and shot. I like to have a steady to wing and shot dog. And all the training manuals, they're always training in the field. Well, how do you translate that into the grouse woods? You know, you're a grouse hunter.
Yeah.
Young aspen is thicker than thick.
Yep.
So how do you transfer, you know, good manners in the field are easy. But when you get into the woods, I mean, sometimes all you do is hear the bird fly. So mm-hmm. I'm always trying to think of ways to develop these young dogs so I can get what I need in the grouse woods. Clear Cut Kennel, that's my kennel name. I love to hunt five years after they clear cut the woods. That's when I start hunting these
mm-hmm.
the habitat, and that is really, really thick cover. So I teach a lot of stop the flush. If mm-hmm. a bird gets up, you have to stop. If I say whoa, you have to stop. And so I use that pigeon. I do a lot of stop the flush work with pigeons. And so when I get to the grouse woods, if my dogs will hear a grouse fly and they'll stop because I've drilled this into their brain so much with pigeons and in the training field. So those are a couple of things I've done to try to improve the chances of that being a good grouse dog or give them every opportunity to learn, you know, in the grouse woods.
Mm-hmm. We'll take a quick sponsor break here. We're talking Field Armor, the toughest dog vest on the market. Help protect your dog from cuts, scrapes, and impalement in the field. A dog vest is much less expensive than an emergency vet. Use promo code BIRDCAMP, BIRDCAMP, with no spaces, for free shipping. Don't miss out on some of their other rugged upland products and visit FieldArmorUSA.com today. And by Pine Hill Gun Dogs, located in Rockford, Michigan. Pine Hill offers boarding and training for your gun dog. Whether it's the pointing or flushing breeds that you love, Pine Hill Gun Dogs wants to be a part of your success this year and wishes to remind you that the greatest conservation tool is a well-trained dog. Scott mentioned over at Pine Hill the other day when I was talking to him that some phone calls have been coming in asking about training, including some folks from Ohio. So if those were listeners of the podcast, they seem to have taken everything with a good sense of humor when I make fun of the Buckeyes. And again, we love your dollars up here in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan. I guess we sell an experience is how we'll say that. But with that, a little bit more on the habitat side of things, right? It's clear-cut kennels. And mm-hmm. as you're evaluating these dogs, you take these young puppies out. Are you noticing something about them? And I'm kind of piggybacking off of what I learned already somewhat this last year. How do you acclimate them to a clear, you know, like the clear cut being that thick, dense unknown where they don't see you anymore, they get away from you a little bit? Have you noticed in 40 years the dogs you're breeding, are they getting maybe easier to adapt into that situation?
Well, I think you have dogs that like to be in thick cover, and you have dogs that get intimidated by the thick cover. So I think there's a genetic component to that as well. One of the things I do, when I'm running a dog, I always run one dog. I want to put all my concentration and training and development on that one dog. But if I have a young dog that's intimidated by the cover and not getting out, I always run a bell. but I put my biggest bell on one of my best bird dogs, and I don't want him to be a bigger running dog. I want him to be a little bit closer running dog, and then I'll turn the pups loose or a pup loose with that dog, and that dog, the older dog, will be in the woods, and the young dog will be by me because he's intimidated by the cover. But that older dog will then come and make a sweep by me, and you'll see that pup hear the bell. Oh, that's him, and he'll run with that older dog. Hmm. And then he'll get out 50, 60 yards with that older dog, and the older dog can outrun him because he's big and tall and is, you know, hunting. And the young dog, oh, my goodness, where's Dad? He can't keep up with the older dog, and he's by himself in the woods. And that dog might even whine a little bit, but eventually he learns he can use his nose to find me. You know, so sometimes they'll circle around. A field traveler won't like this, but they'll circle around, pick up your back trail, and they'll run to the front to you again. Mm-hmm. But once that dog figures out I can use my nose to find Dad, then they start getting more comfortable in the woods. And a lot of times when he hooks up with the older dog, they'll get in the birds up there, and that excites them. So that's one of the ways I build confidence in a young dog. Once they know how to find me and they start running, then I put the older dog away and I just run them individually. Mm-hmm. The other thing I do is I go to the clear cuts and I get 50 bobwhite quail every month from a breeder. And what I do is I go in the best grouse habitat I can find, and I will release 15 to 20 bobwhite quail. And what I do, the story I always tell, and it's how I basically do it, is I put them in a box, I go to my grouse cover on a Sunday evening right after dark. I cut a hole in the box, so in the morning the sun comes up, the quail come out of the box. They're in my good grouse habitat. I have an electronic call bird up in the tree, whistles like a quail every 20 minutes. It goes every 20 minutes, he does that. So if a fox comes along and scatters the bird, that call bird, the quail will all find each other. That call bird can't move, so they all end up back to that tree. Underneath that tree, I have all my feed scattered. So that's where their food supply is. And then that's on a Sunday night I do that. I will bring my pups out the next Saturday, so they've been out for 5 days, and I will bring them, and I beeline for that call bird in the tree. 9 times out of 10, there's going to be 15 bobwhite quail sitting underneath that tree. And they all bust out of there like a wild covey. Mm-hmm. And then I make circles around that call bird, and they will jump and find, point, chase the young quail. They can't catch them because they've been out for a week and they're strong flyers by that time. But they're in that type of habitat, in that cover that otherwise would intimidate them, but now they got something that excites them. And you know, if I have those four pups that I'm bringing through the grouse season, I'll have four bells. So they're playing off each other's bells in there too. And that goes a long ways to bolden up a dog. And I've learned over the years, bobwhite quail in good grouse habitat, that young 5-year-old clear cut, 7-year-old clear cut, will act a lot like a rough grouse. So it's good training for the pups. So that's another thing that I do that really, really helps the pups in their development stage. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice for somebody? And I'm kind of looking here at the notes real quick, and I have on here the note that's minor breed genetic pool. And I know you've touched on a little bit with the Gordons, is not having the availability, you know, in that big wide selection to sometimes choose from. What are some of the things that you would advise somebody who's interested in a minority kind of breed, where there's going to be maybe just less selection? What are some of the easy things that they can do?
Well, give a little bit of the backstory on how I developed my opinion on it is, look at the English Setter, that breed, and then I don't know if your listeners all know what a cover dog trial is, but that's a mm-hmm. field trial in the grouse woods on wild birds. Mm-hmm. The English Setters have kind of dominated that. They've been doing that for over 100 years now. They've been holding cover dog trials in this country, field trials on wild birds. And there's lots of English Setters. There's lots of English Pointers. So the selective process, if you want a grouse dog, go to those cover dog genetics. Those are all proven grouse dogs. The winners of those are all proven on rough grouse. So they got 100 years of genetics. You run that forward to a minor breed like a red setter, a Gordon setter. Those are dominated. I call them white dog trials. For me to bring a Gordon setter into that trial and even just place it would be like winning the national championship in my mind because I have a black dog and I just don't have the same genetics. But I kind of use that as the barometer. So they have a forest of genetics, the English setters and the German shorthairs. The Gordon setters, we're a small little apple orchard. So then you, and I mentioned a little earlier in our conversation, then you want a grouse dog on that. There's only a handful of people breeding Gordon setters for grouse hunting. There's only double, triple that of Gordon setter breeders that are breeding for wild bird hunting. So our genetics, our pool is just is so small. So the advice I give anyone is, I'm a grouse hunter, so if you want a grouse dog, find somebody who breeds and trains and develops and honestly tries to breed better grouse dogs generation after generation. But if it's pheasant, go to someone who pheasant hunts, does the same thing pheasant hunting, or it's chuckers or sharptail. So you got to find somebody that's specifically trying to develop that type of dog. Yeah. That'd be my best advice to anybody looking for, a bird dog for whatever they like to hunt. Find somebody who hunts the bird you like that does it all the time. The other thing I would look for is this whole thing is a science project. You have to have so many dogs so you have a selection. I tell people in the garden setter world, you have eight dogs. You can keep eight dogs. 4 years later, what are your three best dogs? Get rid of the other ones and start, because you want the eight best dogs. That's what I constantly try to do. If you're not getting rid of dogs, you're not really moving your breeding program forward. You can't tell me every single dog is a great dog. So I would love to run these grouse trials. The reason I don't run grouse trials is because these grouse trialers, they'll take a dog and they will campaign that dog. They might campaign two or three dogs. So if I take a Gordon setter and I go to a cover dog trial, I spend the whole weekend to run 45 minutes or an hour, depending upon, what they're running that day, one or two dogs. I choose not to do that because I can load my truck up with eight dogs, go 5 miles from my house, and I can run dogs all, I can run five, six, seven, eight dogs all day long instead of an hour at the trial. I'm going to get more information running my dogs and holding my own field trial with my own dogs and saying, this is the one I need. This one's better than that one, and ranking my dogs. And then the other thing I do is once the dog has proven himself as a really, really good grouse dog, I don't need to run that dog all day, every day for the next 5 years. Now I need to know, will he produce that in the litter box? So it's just like, how many Triple Crown winners go on, once they win the Triple Crown, they don't go and continue racing. They go out the pasture, and they're a stud horse or a brood mare because there's more value in that. They've proven themselves. So once you've proven a dog, now he's going to be your broodmate, and now you're looking for the next one. So look for people that have that kind of mentality. But there's a lot of people that will buy a clear-cut dog or a dog from a reputable breeder, and they will, it's a good dog, and they breed. They'll have a litter of pups on them. Those more than likely are going to be some pretty good dogs because the genetics are there because of somebody's program. I always say the other thing to look at is look at the pedigree. And I'll just use my kennel because my kennel name is Clear Cut. So every single one of my dog is Clear Cut Jim, Clear Cut Roy, Clear Cut. Every dog I breed starts out with my kennel name, Clear Cut. If you're looking at a pedigree, if one of my pedigrees and there's Clear Cut dogs in there 7, 8, 12 times, I must be breeding something I like because I'm breeding my own dogs. if there's clear cut in there twice, I must not like my dogs because I have to go to somebody else's dog because I'm not happy with what I got in my line breeding. So I'm pulling in, have to pull in dogs. So that pedigree will tell you a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
If Berg brothers, you look at their pedigrees. I haven't looked at one in a while, but there's probably Berg brother in 4, 5, 6 generations because they got a breeding program put together that they're developed or they're producing what they want. So they're line breeding it. When you start seeing, you know, 6, 7, 8 different kinds of kennel names in a pedigree, that's not a line breeding program anymore. That's just somebody's chasing the winner or they're just doing it for money or, or, you know, so those are the types of things I look at, which I don't know if the public or your average puppy buyer looks into it that deeply, but those are some things if you're interested in buying a pup to look for.
That kind of goes along with the advice of you pick the breeder rather than the dog, because what you're saying there is, you're demonstrating your work when you hand that pedigree off and you say, these are, you know, aside from an outcross in there, these are all my dogs. So this is all my work going forward. Mm-hmm. And it does show that you've been doing it a while. It also does show that, okay, I'm seeing what I like. And you made a point though earlier, and I want to stress this to people listening again, when you said out of your top 8 dogs, if you haven't rotated out numbers 4 through 8 at some point, and these are just the 8 you always have, that means you haven't found a better one than the bottom half of your pool. You've never, you haven't produced a better one either then at that point. So, okay. So, you know, you've lost your momentum moving forward if you're not replacing dogs at the bottom of your lineup.
Yeah. Well said. It's exactly correct in my mind. It's a science project. You're always, sometimes you take, and if you see another kennel name in your pedigree, like I have a spring set dog that I bought from Spring Set Kennel out in Oregon because I wanted to get a little bit better retrieve in my dog. So I at Clear Cut Kennel, I had this great spring set dog here a couple of years ago, retrieved so naturally, ran out, picked it up, ran it back to hand, gave it to me, the hand, I'm going, where did you come from? Well, I called Laura up at Spring Set Kennel, and I said, I have this dog in my kennel, and please get as close as you possibly can to this dog and send me a pup. And she says, why? Because I said, I need that retrieve in my dog. So now I have that dog, and it's my second, and he proved himself as a grouse dog. He's a wonderful, wonderful grouse dog. But the main reason he's in my kennel right now is because I'm getting better retrieve out of those pups. But if you have a line breed, you can do that. You can pull in something you might be lacking, pick it up from that dog, but then you better go, you have to go back to that dog 2 or 3 times to cement it into your line. You can't just do it once and say you got it. So now I'll take a pup out of this, breed it to something else, and then I'll breed back to that spring set dog again to get him back in the pedigree. But it's the same dog. You might see that dog in my 5 years from now, you might see him in there 4 more times. But all those pups are that I got out of that stud dog that's got that great retrieve has 40 years of my line breeding of grouse dogs in it. So it, you pull in one trait because you're lacking it. That's how you breed dogs. So that's the one thing I did. You picked the dog out, Laura. I didn't care. I wanted it to be a male. And 6 months later, she calls me up. I have a dog for you. And that's, you know, one of the things that I've done here, and I'm getting better retrieve, more natural retrieve out of some of my dogs right now.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing.
Yep. And that's one of the things I value as somebody who does all kinds of different disciplines of shotgunning and wing shooting is a dog that finds that down bird and brings it back to me is I put that on a high priority, not quite as high as a good point, but, or energetic flush because I have hunted over flushers as well. But, one last sponsor break and we'll keep moving. Second Chance Bird Dogs. A perfect fit doesn't always happen for a puppy. A dog at Second Chance learns its job. Dogs. I still can't read today. Birds, guns, and teamwork with the handler are milestones on a journey to a new home and life. The training a Second Chance Bird Dog receives helps it make the most of its second chance. It could be my absolutely sloppy left-handed writing. Collar Clinic as well, located in northern Michigan and providing e-collar, GPS, and other dog-related electronics since 1988. Collar Clinic can provide new and reconditioned systems and accessories of many major brands. They also repair current and older systems, and when you're ready to upgrade, also have a trade-in program for the working and non-working systems. Get the tools you need to make your dog exceptional at Collar Clinic. And be sure to use the discount code BIRDCAMP on your next purchase. With that, I have two little notes left on here. The one of which, and I have just in here the phrase, the best kind of advertisement. And I've had to use this advice on some folks that asked me my opinion. And I didn't really have any really good advice other than, for the most part, if you decide to be observant, things happen. But the best kind of advertisement, I told them just go look at the person's pictures.
Before the internet age, back when I started this back in the 80s, what I would do, and my thought pattern was, and the show people, we have the Gordon, the AKC has a breed club, the Gordon Setter Club of America, and I would take a picture, and I'd show a limit of rough grouse that I shot off point over one of my dogs, and some people would get a little offended by that. Why do you always show those dead birds in those pictures? And I said, first of all, you can't pen raise rough grouse. If there's a dead bird in the picture and it's a rough grouse, it's a wild bird. You can't say that about pheasant and huns and a lot of the other types of birds. So that was the one thing. So that's the one thing that I did early on. Now with the internet, it's kind of changed things. Mm-hmm. And to me, word of mouth is probably the best thing. I've got enough dogs out there where I've never really advertised. I guess I advertise a little bit in Gun Dog Magazine and a couple of those early on. And then I would put ads in the local paper, like in North Dakota in some small town or Fargo or whatever, because I figure there's a lot of hunters out there. And that's worked out a little bit for me. But the best thing is somebody loves their puppy. I have people that are on their third and fourth dog from, you know, and families that every one of their kids have a clear-cut dog. But it's because the dog did what it was supposed to do after they bought it. And my job is to give them a good family dog and to put, you know, good grouse genetics in that pup so when they go grouse hunting or pheasant hunting or whatever type of hunting, it's going to do what it was bred to do. And then they bring their buddies out and they start bragging about their dogs. And that's, to me, is the best advertisement, is that. You know, going back to the dead bird picture, is my philosophy was, if somebody sees that and they're a true grouse hunter and they're looking for a dog, I'm going to get a phone call. Well, that guy's obviously shooting grouse, you know, with this. So it's got to be a grouse dog, and I'm a grouse hunter, so it produced a lot of phone calls is what it did. So that was early on, that was my number one advertisement. But I think over the years, it's just word of mouth. Mm-hmm. People have had my dogs that enjoy them, and I tell, you know, they're line bred dogs. And when you get a line bred dog, they look the same, they act the same, they're all going to be within the same weight, within a couple pounds of each other. Their coats are all going to be the same. Then their heads are going to be the same. I have people tell me, I can look at a picture, and if you cover up the name of the dog, I can tell you the clear-cut dogs because I got a certain look in my kennel. It's 40 years of breeding. Mm-hmm. So go to a breeder that line breeds a dog of the type of dog that you like. And you know, they look, act, and hunt the same because they're line bred. So you get enough of those dogs out there and people start hunting. And, you know, bird hunting world is pretty small.
It is.
You know, I've had somebody out in South Dakota with one of my dogs, and they were getting out of their motel room to go hunting in the morning, and there was another Gordon Setter in the parking lot, and they started talking. It was a clear-cut dog, and the person who had the other dog was a clear-cut dog, and I go by the alphabet, so my first breeding was clear-cut, and then the next word had to start with an A. That's the A litter. So then clear cut, the second litter would be clear cut, and the next word's got to start with a B, like bird, dog, buck. So they sat there and they figured out who the parents were just because they knew that that's what we did with our name. But what's the chance of two Gordon setters being in the same motel in the middle of South Dakota pheasant hunting season?
Yeah.
So it's a small world. We think there's a lot of us out there, but the real hardcore hunters are, it's a pretty small fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's pretty cool.
Yes, it is indeed. My last thing is, of course, always the famous question, and it sometimes varies, but I haven't varied it this time. And that is, if you could hunt or shoot with one particular gun from history, what would it be and where would you take it?
You know, you kind of primed me for that question. Right now I shoot a CZ Bobwhite, double trigger.
Mm-hmm.
I've always shot double trigger shotguns, and they've always been double barrels, either over unders or side by side. My dad bought a Ruger Red Label, and we swapped guns one time, and I'm always looking for that second trigger. You could never find it. So I'm one of those guys that has to have a double trigger on it, but the old guns, most of them did. I would like to say a Parker side-by-side, but mm-hmm. if I was going to be really honest about it, one of my very, very first guns I had when I was a poor college kid was a Marlin Model 90 over and under, and I shot that thing really well for so many years, and it just got such loose action on it, I just kind of retired the gun. And if I could go back in time and buy a brand new Marlin Model 90 over and under double trigger and a 16 gauge, that would be the gun that I would probably in my heart like the most, just because it was my first really, really good gun that I shot well.
Mm.
I just wore the gun out. And it's not anything fancy, but I fell in love with that gun. And if I could get a brand new one off the shelf, that's the one I think I would go with.
Huh.
I'd cherish it forever.
Yeah.
That's not a Parker. It's not a Greener. It's not a Darnay. It's a Marlin Model 90.
Well, you're pushing the edge of the spectrum a little on that question, but we've had everything from incredibly ornate recommendations all the way down to somebody did say his grandpa's Model 37 Ithaca, and every one of those guns somebody has said is either priceless or nearly to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so yep. you're still well within the accepted range of answers there for that one.
Having said that, what's still on my bucket list
mm-hmm.
is I'd like to get a side-by-side muzzleloader.
Ooh.
And shoot a limited rough grouse off point over one of my dogs. That's still on my bucket list to do. So,
okay.
I think that would be something I can do in my retirement for a little bit of fun. I don't know if I can do it, but I would like to try. So.
Right, right. Yeah. So probably like one of those Peter Soley hammer guns that they have.
Yep, it'd almost have to be a hammer gun.
It would.
I would like to say it would be a flintlock, but it would probably be a cap gun, a percussion cap.
You do want it to work at least 5 times.
Yeah. So that's kind of on my bucket list of things to still do while I'm able. So.
That would be fun. Cool. All right, I'm going to have you stay on the minute here, and we'll just stay on after I hit cut here. And
I want to say thank you very much. It was fun talk, and I hope some people find entertainment and some value of what I said. I just love good bird dogs and good grouse dogs specifically. So thank you very much for having me on, and it was.
I'd like to take a minute here at the very end to thank you all again for listening. Again, I appreciate it, and I appreciate those who support the podcast. If you can, please go through the process of rating, reviewing, subscribing, sharing with a friend, any of the things that would publicize the podcast a little bit more and get out to a few more ears. You never know where our next fan will be found, and hopefully you can help spread the word a little bit more about BirdCamp. If you want to contact us, of course, mi.birdcamp@gmail.com is the best way to do it. Might take me a day or two to respond, but once it's in writing, it's going to be easy to find and get back to you with, as well as Bird Camp on Facebook and Bird Camp Pod on Instagram. Anyway, with those, again, thank you very much for listening, and I will see you, or you will hear me, on the next episode.